You are listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. There are a few reasons you might have your eyes tilted to the night skies this week. Maybe you saw that streak in the sky over New York on Saturday night around 7:30 p.m. It was actually a rocket launch from Cape Canaveral, Florida, one of Elon Musk's SpaceX rockets blasting off in time to catch the last light of the sun. Or maybe you've heard that this week, as in now, is the best view of Jupiter that we'll get in our lifetimes. It hasn't been this close or this bright since 1951. And it won't be again until the year 2129. So get out there, find a friend with a telescope or some binoculars, or go to AAA.org to see where New York City's Astronomy Club, what they have going on. It has also been reported that one might even see a few of Jupiter's 80 moons. Oh, yeah, and then there's the fact that a NASA spacecraft slammed into an asteroid last night. Joining me now to talk all things space is Kate Howells, communication strategist and space policy advisor for the Planetary Society. Kate is the author of Space is Cool as F, a science columnist for the editorial magazine, and creator, writer, and producer of the digital series, Whoa. Kate, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. There is definitely a lot of space stuff to talk about, as you said.
A lot of space news. And listeners, we want to get you in on this conversation if you want to geek out with us. Did you watch yesterday's NASA live stream when they crashed the probe into the asteroid? Or maybe you've caught a good look at Jupiter at its biggest and brightest. Give us a call and join the conversation. 212-433-9692. 212-433-WNYC. Or maybe you have another space comment or question you want to geek out with us with space science communicator Kate Howells. So, Kate, I mentioned the SpaceX launch that folks in our area might have seen on the weekend. It was part of Elon Musk's company Starlink project. So what is Starlink exactly? What's the plan?
So Starlink is a bit of a contentious project, but the idea is to send what's called a mega constellation. So we're talking thousands and thousands of small satellites orbiting the Earth that collectively provide a global internet network. And the idea behind this is to provide internet to remote areas, rural areas that don't currently have high-speed internet. But the problem is that it's also clogging up space. Basically, all the radio communication that these satellites use to do their job interferes with radio astronomy. They also, just having this many satellites in orbit interferes with optical astronomy. So if you've got a telescope and you're taking like a long exposure of, say, Jupiter right now, you're going to have all these streaks going past it. So the science community is pretty outraged that this, you know, this private company with this, you know, money-making endeavor, you know, there's this idea of providing internet to people who don't have it, but, you know, they're out to make money at the end of the day as well, that this is happening at the expense of science. So it's a bit of a battle, but regardless, you did get to see a really cool thing if you were in New York looking up that night. My understanding is that the rocket was high enough up in the atmosphere that even though it was dark on Earth, there was still sunlight catching it up high. So it was illuminated in this very dramatic way. So that's the thing. Even when space is, you know, questionable in its motives, it's always still kind of cool and beautiful.
What are the limits to what someone like Elon Musk can do in space that this great. Is possible, that this can happen?
Yeah, great question. So because he's launching from the United States, it's the FCC that is overseeing what he's allowed to do. And then there are international groups as well, like the International Telecommunications Union, that have some say over, you know, who takes up what bands of like radio frequency and that kind of thing, because you can't interfere with each other. Two people can't be communicating on the same radio band. Like if you've ever used a walkie-talkie and you are on the same frequency as somebody else, like it interferes. So, and there's a limited number of radio bands that we can use to communicate or do things, send information. So I think projects like Starlink are really bringing up how limited our policy mechanisms are for controlling this kind of thing. Because yeah, the US can decide you're allowed to launch these things, but then another country might have ruled otherwise, but because they're not the launching state, they don't get a say. So it gets complicated and it brings up the limits of international influence on stuff like this.
And my personal obsession, space junk.
Yeah.
Will this impact the issue of space junk, which is a real issue?
Absolutely. Yeah, you can't launch tens of thousands of satellites into orbit without adding to the problem of there being just too much stuff in orbit, because, you know, realistically, the area around Earth where satellites orbit is huge, but it's not unlimited. It's not infinite. And so you do get congestion. And if there is ever a collision between, say, two defunct satellites, they don't have any propellant on board anymore, so you can't control their trajectory. If they crash into each other and they create a bunch of debris, now you've got even more stuff in orbit. And so it is a problem. And again, it's something that, you know, humanity as a whole is grappling with: sustainable growth. How do we grow and develop in sustainable ways environmentally, et cetera? It's the same thing applies to space.
Let's take a call. Tom is calling in from Franklin Square. Hi, Tom. Thanks for calling All of It. What space news has you excited?
Oh, my God. The asteroid, the DART landing, crash landing, I watched it live on C-SPAN. Incredible. And speaking of space junk, so happy to hear they waited for the asteroid to pass us before they started screwing around with it so it won't come back at us.
Tom, thanks for calling in. That is not the technical term, screwing around with the asteroid, Kate. let's talk about what Tom was discussing. It was a NASA mission launched last November, finished its mission yesterday after 7 p.m. A 1,300-pound probe crashed into an asteroid at 14,000 miles per hour. It's the DART mission. What is NASA hoping to learn from this DART mission?
Yeah, so DART is basically humanity's first ever attempt to move something in space. You know, other than stuff that we've launched ourselves, this is the first time we've tried to move a celestial object. So the reason we want to do this is that if ever there is an asteroid heading for a collision with Earth, we want to be able to do something about that. You know, movies like Armageddon and Deep Impact, you know, paint an optimistic picture that we could just, you know, find something that's going to hit us in a week. Bruce Willis, either one, send somebody.
Some guy with a strong jaw and a lot.
Yeah. So an action star goes and explodes it and everything's fine. That's just not the way it works. And currently we do not have a method of deflecting an asteroid that's heading for Earth. So DART, which stands for the Double Asteroid Redirection Test, was a mission to try this for the first time. So it smashed last night, dramatically smashed into a relatively small asteroid called Dimorphos, which is actually in orbit around a larger asteroid called Didymos. Neither of these is on an impact course with the Earth. They're not going to hit Earth ever, basically, as far as calculations show. But they're among the type of asteroids that could and have hit Earth in the past. So for people who maybe remember about, I think it was in 2014, around then, there was an asteroid that exploded over Chelyabinsk in Russia, and it didn't kill anybody, but it hurt like 1,500 people. It blew windows out. It was this huge fireball across the sky, very dramatic. That was a 60-foot asteroid, which is pretty small. Dimorphos, which we impacted yesterday, is about 560 feet. So it's like the size of a football stadium is the analogy I've been hearing. And if an asteroid that size were to hit Earth, it could destroy entire countries. It could create, you know, tsunamis that would wipe out even more countries. It'd be very bad. So they took this spacecraft that was about the size of a fridge, and they launched it from Earth, and it was moving at about 4 miles per second when it smashed into Dimorphos. And I love to just try to contemplate for a second what 4 miles per second looks like, or what that is like. It's just inconceivable here on Earth. But out in space, there's nothing to slow you down. You can go pretty quickly. So it smashed into the asteroid. There was live camera footage coming from the spacecraft as it approached. So you see this thing just go from a tiny speck to bigger, to bigger, to bigger, until it takes up the whole frame. And then it just was a very dramatic red screen, you know, as the camera was destroyed by the impact. And the caller described it as a crash landing. It was definitely more of like a just complete crash demolition. Like that thing is, the spacecraft is obliterated by that impact. But now follow-up observations from ground-based telescopes, from the James Webb Space Telescope, from, you know, everything we've got is going to be looking now at this asteroid to see if we've changed its trajectory through space. So we're going to see if this impact has affected it. There's no reason to expect it won't have affected it, but this is just our first time really testing this kind of thing out. So now, if this works, we'll have a sense of, you know, how big of a spacecraft would we need to send if like an Armageddon-style asteroid was coming for Earth and that kind of thing.
This leads me, and this might sound a little silly, but as I'm hearing this and thinking about we humans and our fallibility and we're going to space and conducting these kind of extraordinary experiments, are there other ethical conversations around this? Are there astroethicists about whether or not we should be doing this?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, so there's several angles, and especially when it comes to planetary defense, which is the effort to, you know, plan to defend the Earth from asteroid impacts. There are a lot of questions like, okay, say there's an asteroid and it's heading for Earth, and it's going to impact Washington, D.C. You know, let's go with the full like Armageddon style scenario. And NASA is able to send a mission that deflects it, but it might deflect it just far enough that it hits like Sydney, Australia. You know, what are the ethical implications of that? Is that legally allowed if what they're trying to do is not get off course altogether to miss the Earth? You know, it's like that two-track, you know, ethical conundrum of the train barreling down to hit one person. Do you switch it, et cetera? There's also a lot of ethical questions in space exploration around the possibility of life on another planet or moon or asteroid. You know, I was joking with my colleagues last night that, you know, what if you're zooming in as you see the camera footage of approaching this asteroid and you just see, you know, a little creature on it right before impact. You know, that's very unlikely. We don't think there's going to be life on an asteroid like this. But when we send spacecraft to Mars, all of these planned missions to send humans to Mars, there's a huge ethical question of, might we be disrupting indigenous life there, you know, microbial or otherwise? You know, do we have a responsibility to just sort of stay where we are and observe from a distance? There's no solid answer, but it's an interesting question to discuss for sure.
My guest is Kate Howells, communication strategist and space policy advisor for the Planetary Society. We're talking about all the big space news. Jupiter, huge news this week. Right now, we've got two events lining up. One is that Jupiter is in opposition, and then Jupiter is in, correct me if I say this wrong, perihelion?
Correct. Yes. So what this means is, so Jupiter is in opposition every year. I think it's every 13 months or so, basically once a year. And this just means that as the Earth goes around the sun, it goes in a smaller orbit because it's closer to the sun. So it takes less time. Jupiter moves more slowly. So every, I think, 13 months or so, Earth basically laps Jupiter and finds itself with the sun on one side and Jupiter on the opposite side. And what this means is that Jupiter is fully illuminated by the sun from the perspective of Earth on our night side. So if you're looking out at the night sky, the Earth is directly behind, I mean, the sun is directly behind you, basically on the opposite side of the planet. Jupiter is directly in front of you. So you're seeing it just bathed in sunlight. So that's what's happening right now at opposition. The other thing that's happening is perihelion. And this has to do with the fact that Jupiter's orbit around the sun isn't perfectly circular. Mm-hmm. It's kind of an elliptical shape. So sometimes it's further from the sun and sometimes it's closer to the sun. And likewise, that means sometimes it's further from Earth, sometimes it's closer to Earth. So right now it's at its closest point to Earth and to the sun. And it's also on the opposite side of the Earth from the sun. So you're getting this combination of a close Jupiter and a bathed in sunlight Jupiter. So it's just the perfect time to observe it. Here in Ontario, where I live, it's been cloudy, so I haven't been able to see it, which is tragic. I feel like it happens every time there's, you know, a lunar eclipse or something like this. It's always cloudy, but hopefully listeners are having a bit more luck.
If people want to have good luck in seeing it, can you give people some advice about what they should do, where they should go, what kind of equipment they might try to get close to?
Jupiter is so bright right now that you should be able to see it even in a city. I mean, maybe if you're in like Times Square, you won't be able to, but somewhere where, I mean, the farthest you can get away from bright light, the better, but you should be able to see it from a lot of places. And it's rising at sunset and it's setting at sunrise. So anytime that you go out after dark, before dawn, you should be able to see it. And it's basically the brightest thing right now. It looks like a star, but extremely bright. And if you're, because we're in the northern hemisphere, and you know most things in space are kind of lined up along the equator, it'll be a bit to the south. So you'll look in the southern skies, but it's crossing the sky over the course of the night. It's hard to miss. It's very bright, and you can see it with your bare eyes. If you got binoculars, that'll help. And if you got a telescope, that's fantastic. And you might be able to see some of the moons of Jupiter. As you mentioned in the intro, Jupiter has just a ridiculous number of moons, but it's got four that are very big and very bright. And you can see those as dots sort of lined up on either side of Jupiter if you look at it through a telescope or maybe even binoculars.
One last question in our last minute. I think people know that there was a scrubbed launch pad. The Artemis was scrapped, the launch, and that's been happening and happening. They've been trying 5 days later. There's a hurricane approaching. Are these major setbacks built into these long missions, or are they really problematic?
No, it's pretty much what you'd expect. I mean, Artemis, this series of Artemis missions to eventually get people back on the moon, it's all launching on a rocket called the Space Launch System that's been in development for decades, and tens of billions of dollars have gone into it. So they don't want to mess it up. They don't want to take any chances. So they're going to wait till the conditions are right. They're going to do a bunch of tests, make sure everything's working properly, and then they'll launch it. So it is completely expected that there will be delays and delays and delays like this, but we will eventually see that rocket go up, and it'll be pretty spectacular because it's a humongous rocket.
Kate Howells is communications strategist and space policy advisor for the Planetary Society, author of Space as Cool as F, a science columnist for the editorial magazine, and creator and writer producer of the digital series Whoa. Kate, we always love having you on the show. Thanks so much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
And that is all of it for today. I'm Allison Stewart. I appreciate you listening, and I appreciate you. I will meet you back here next time.